Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
Good evening, and welcome to Views of the Nose, the show that this week is going to focus on news media response to crises and other sorts of exceptional events. I'm your substitute host, Lee Wilkins, and with me in the Reynolds Journalism Institute studio are faculty colleagues, Professors Margaret Duffy, head of the Journalism School Strategic Communication Sequence, and Professor Emeritus Rod Gillette, who actually invented this program about 17 years ago. We'll begin with a discussion of the events in Aurora, Colorado, early last Friday morning when a graduate student in neuroscience at the University of Colorado, who has been described in media accounts as armed for war, went into a midnight premiere of the latest Batman movie and opened fire. As of this taping, the death toll stands at 12, with some of the more than 50 injured remaining in the hospital in critical condition. Since then, we've seen images of the first court appearance of the accused gunman James Holmes, and the visual information in that video has provided a lot of fodder for commentary. This is a story that has been difficult to avoid, and there have been some interesting as well as predictable twists. Next, we'll move to the second really awful story of the week, the NCAA sanctions against Penn State University for the institution's apparent complicity in the cover-up of assistant football coaches Jerry Sandusky's serial pedophilia. None of us is an expert in college sports, so we're going to focus on what we think journalists, particularly sports journalists, should have told readers and viewers. We'll also take a look at the public response to the sanctions on the Twitterverse. And we'll also spend some time talking about what we think Columbia journalists should be doing to localize this story at a time when the University of Missouri is changing athletic conferences. Having had our fill of tragedy, we'll turn to a sports story that can sometimes exalt the human spirit, the 2012 Olympics in London. NBC Universal paid almost $2 billion for the rights to the Games, and this year, for the first time, viewers will be able to watch live streaming of every single Olympic event, plus event coverage on 9 separate television channels, all owned by the parent conglomerate. That coverage is probably going to emphasize just a few things while ignoring many others. We'll try to provide some insight on what to expect, whether your passion is swimming, basketball, track and field, or the equestrian events. And since we're across the pond, we'll also briefly revisit the latest events in the phone hacking scandal, including criminal charges now filed against 8 journalists connected with Rupert Murdoch's tabloid newspaper empire. And then, at Rod's suggestion, we'll take a look at the local garbage controversy. Why has there been so much public commentary about Columbia's plans to change from plastic bag to rolling plastic bins as part of the city's garbage collection service? Links to news coverage from both the Missourian and the Columbia Daily Tribune are provided on our blog about this story and all the others that I have mentioned, and which you may access through the KBIA website. But, Margaret and Rod, let's begin with the Colorado shooting. And at this point, I need to do some disclosure. I was raised in Aurora, Colorado. One of the people who died was a graduate of my high school, of course, several decades after I was there. This morning, Colorado Governor John Hickenlooper gave a speech in honor of the victims, in which he noted that he was making a deliberate choice not to mention the name of the alleged gunman. Hickenlooper said his omission was an attempt to deny James Holmes his 15 minutes of fame. Margaret, as a scholar concerned with both culture and advertising, the media is clearly implicated in this sort of statement. Based on what you've been able to look at, what sort of story are we writing and broadcasting about the Colorado shooting? How implicated are we in these sorts of events?
I think maybe we want to start out by talking about advertising a little bit, because advertising is very complicated in this kind of situation. The media get accused all of the time of, oh, wow, we're going to get millions and millions of viewers. The advertisers are saying, oh, dear, how can we possibly advertise, and can we get things pulled so as not to be offensive, insensitive, and really present a bad make a bad situation worse. And you probably noticed that Romney and Obama pulled their mostly negative advertising in during the aftermath.
Indeed, they did.
A couple of other things, and I've got a couple of quotes, but one of the things I thought was terribly disturbing was how quickly this was politicized and how quickly speculation ran rampant among the media. The worst, well, if you remember Gabby Gifford's shooting, that immediately became a huge situation. I actually saw this from Brian Ross talking to, I'm looking at the exact quote, to George Stephanopoulos. There's a Jim Holmes of Aurora, Colorado. He's got a page on the Colorado Tea Party site, as well as him talking about the Tea Party last year. Now, we don't really know if this is the same Jim Holmes, but it's Jim Holmes of Aurora, Colorado. Really? Did he just Google Jim Holmes? Well, of course, it was the wrong Jim Holmes.
They did clarify it.
Yes.
ABC tried to back away from that a little bit later and corrected it. But as you noticed, also there are somebody did another online search. They found there were 6 James Holmes in the Denver area and 20-some in the state of Colorado. Lord knows how many aren't even listed in a directory. Mm-hmm. But there was an example of you pick a name and you run with it in an attempt to provide some kind of an identification for your viewing audience, which turned out to be totally incorrect. Before we go any farther, can I pick up on your advertising? Mm-hmm. And I wanted to seem to be a good segue to this. On page 5 of last Saturday's Columbia Daily Tribune, the news stories on page 5 are all related to the shooting. And at the bottom of the page, an ad, ZK Guns, the one-year customer bash, and among the prizes to be awarded, it will be a bolt-action rifle, a pistol, and an AR-15. Now, that was a coincidence. Probably nobody paid any attention to what is the placement of this ad or where are we placing it, but there it was.
Well, I guess one of the things that this has brought up for me, I was really intrigued with how the news media covered the court appearance because there was so much discussion about what Mr. Holmes looked like and so much discussion about was he agitated? Was he asleep? Was he ignoring everything that was going on? And it's one of those places where I thought, can't we just shut up? Because actually we don't know. And sort of trying to fill that silence, in a lot of ways offended me, and I'm not sure it did us any favors in terms of credibility, and I'm pretty sure that it didn't do Mr. Holmes any favors, regardless of, you know, what his mental state was or wasn't. I guess I'd sort of like to ask you both, Margaret, does the 15 minutes of fame thing resonate at all with you, or is this just kind of a backhanded way of saying, well, we don't have anything else to blame it on, so we'll blame it on some poor person deciding that he wants to be in the news?
Well, one of the things that we saw in this particular situation was more the Boston Globe, for instance, found an academic to do a clinical diagnosis of this guy, apparently only by watching television, and decided that it was the result of bullying. Someone else decided it was another expert who was interviewed by CNN said, oh, no, it was violent video games. And another said, this is their way of getting 15 minutes of fame. I mean, it's not based on anything really factual. I think it's the need to fill time in a kind of really exploitative way.
And whatever for whatever reason, the judge has now said there will be no more cameras in the courtroom mm-hmm. for any further court appearances by this guy. Whether it's related to his bizarre appearance, whether it's related to all the speculation about was he on medication, was he acting. Now, the judge's reasoning, at least that which has been made public, is even an accused man deserves a fair trial. So therefore, we won't have cameras in the courtroom, which pretty well puts holes in all the arguments we have given for years for why there should be cameras in the courtroom mm-hmm. to assure a fair trial.
Mm-hmm. I think the other interesting thing that I picked up is, of course, after one of these mass shootings, and, you know, in Colorado we have Columbine, and there was a lot of initial linkage of what happened at Columbine to what happened here. The place that my mind went, because it was Aurora, was before Columbine, there was Chuck E. Cheese. Chuck E. Cheese is actually a restaurant in Aurora. It's obviously like the one we have here in Columbia, where some person walked in and just blew away 13 people for no good reason. It's really the first mass shooting in Colorado, and then Columbine came afterwards. But what struck me was the number of commentating panel discussions that I sort of looped in on that said, boy, whatever else we're going to do as a result of this, we're not going to talk about gun control. Mm-hmm. Gun control is politically off the table. And I was just kind of stunned. Margaret, how does that all work?
Well, I think it's so interesting that the narrative has been from, of course, it has been from Fox News and everybody reporting the same talking points, which is, now is not the time to talk about gun control. Of course, that leads one to say, well, when would be the time to talk about gun control? And I think it's an indication of how far the country has moved for a variety of reasons. And it's an indication of how, I think, unfortunately, the media follow that discussion. And they're not setting the agenda in a particular way. They're going along with somebody else's agenda.
I guess it's almost as if we're refusing to do any independent thinking
exactly.
on our own. Well, from one awfulness to the next. So next, Rod, I want to talk a little bit about Penn State.
Can I make one more comment
Absolutely.
About this Aurora situation? The similarity between this and the incident, the shooting at Tucson in January of 2011, is so similar in terms of the accused person, mm-hmm. who now, of course, still is in a Springfield, Missouri medical facility, supposedly being readied for trial eventually. Mm-hmm. But I've heard very little reference to him in this latest situation. It kind of surprises me. Okay. I'm sorry.
No, it's perfectly okay. So we're going to make only a little bit of a U-turn here and begin to talk about Penn State. Rod, I want to ask you, how would you evaluate the coverage, particularly by sports journalists, of the sanctions and their impact on the Penn State football program?
Most of the coverage, I think, has been yay for Mark Emmert and the NCAA. We needed some kind of punishment. There's also been some criticism from some of the sports writers and commentators that this is way beyond what the punishment should be, that any penalty on the university, any penalty involving those who were directly involved, yes. But how is this, and this is the line that I see being taken, how is this going to affect those players who are yet to come in to Penn State? Some of whom, as I heard mentioned today, were only 4 years old when this activity began. How is it going to affect the economy of the community? In other words, the whole student body and the whole region around State College are going to suffer in some respect. Is that fair? And that's a question I'm not able to answer, certainly.
Well, to me, it's been interesting because when the sanctions were announced, I actually needed somebody, and one of our graduate students did, explain to me why are they significant in this particular way, because I didn't really understand the whole thing about the loss of scholarships. But that was something that I was actually hoping sports journalists were going to sit down and explain to those of us who were not sports enthusiasts why this mattered so much and how long it conceivably might, I'm going to use the word cripple, I'm not sure if that's totally accurate, the football program at Penn State. On the other hand, I've seen a fair amount of stuff that I actually think is factually inaccurate. For example, there was a guest on Democracy Now! Who claimed that the university would pay a fine by cutting funding for other sports, a move that the sanctions expressly forbid. Margaret, do you think this is an area where our journalistic boosterism is just running amok and completely ahead of the facts?
Well, clearly speculation, and again, the interviewing of experts who are non-experts, and their declarations are taken as something that is reportable and useful to report, regardless of how inaccurate they might be. And I just think that's one of the really terrible kinds of situations that arise And it also, I think, says, and I'm a sports fan, I will say, it talks to me about the culture of sports and how it really runs big universities, their agendas, and their cultures.
So, Rod, that's a great segue to the next question I wanted to ask you, which I think this is a story with a lot of local implications. I don't think I'm alone. So if you were counseling local journalists, sports and otherwise, how to localize this story, what are some of the things you suggest?
Well, there's the standard thing you would suggest, which is, okay, reporters, go over to the athletic department, go through all their files, put in a request for information, and see what you can dig up. The other thing that's been running through my mind was that fact that both of our local papers, I think, in a subtle, perhaps not too subtle a fashion, have been alluding to this, and that is, we could very easily be on that same slippery slope. Fortunately, we don't have any pedophiles running around or psychopaths, and everything seems to be under control. But what is really beginning to dominate this campus? And I've turned to a column that was in last night's Tribune, written by a Bob Ford of the Philadelphia Inquirer. And toward the end of this column, he says, if the NCAA truly believed in that stance that it has taken, then it would move to change the very structure of collegiate football in this country and not merely decimate one program just because it can. If the massive football revenue and the worship and influence it brings could get so badly out of whack at Penn State, then it can happen anywhere. Not every school is going to be confronted with the presence of a rogue psychopath, but every school is susceptible to sliding down an ethical slope to protect the cash cow. And that, as I say, that is the message that I would hope is being absorbed and sinking in a lot of front offices these days.
Well, I'd also add that, though this story died very quickly, Coach Pinkel made a very unfortunate comment, very unacceptable to many people, regarding how Joe Paterno should not be, I don't have the direct quote, but he should not be blamed for this, and those kinds of things, which seemed to many observers to be very dismissive of the genuine, unbelievable, unspeakable crimes that went on. And I think those kinds of, those lack of awareness of how football and major sports at Division I programs begins to take over in a cultural standpoint. I think that some of, I don't think Coach Pinkel is a bad man or meant anything bad by it, but I think it's a perspective that is really significant and disturbing.
He did try to clarify that in an interview a couple of days later. Given the benefit of the doubt, I think he was caught off guard in Hoover, Alabama. Mm-hmm. Where the SEC conference meeting was being held, and just didn't expect that question. And
But Ron, I think you've put your finger on something that's really important. Which I agree. I think he probably was caught off guard. He didn't expect that question, but he should have. And so should everybody at this university be expecting questions about what do you have in place to ensure that this doesn't happen? What are the safeguards to prevent? You know, to sort of if not put up a wall, at least a semi-permeable membrane between that monetary engine that is sports and some of the rest of the things that we do on campus. So I actually think that there's a lot of coverage that we should be doing locally, and truthfully, I haven't seen much of it. Well, Margaret, what I did see this morning was the U.S. soccer team beat the French. I have to admit, I like watching the Olympics, and apparently I'm going to be able to do a lot of it this year. But sports, to me, seems to be a chance to do a really good job of storytelling on many levels. So tell us, oh, narrative queen, what should we be looking out for?
Well, you have the opportunity for binge TV viewing for about 2 weeks. One of the things that I think is really interesting about what NBC has done, and they started it in 1992 with Dick Ebersol, who is a brilliant producer. And Ebersol used research, and he and his team figured out that what people wanted was personal stories of achievement, overcoming obstacles. 60% of the viewers are women who appear to really like those. The men like them too, as long with who's winning and the stats. So making these athletes into sympathetic characters with great backstories, you will see this woven into every single sports commentary.
And if I understand correctly, not just every single sports commentary. I think we have a little bit of a clip of an ad, a Procter & Gamble ad, right, Margaret, that sort of does the same thing here. And for the radio, the folks who are seeing, who are listening to this on the radio, you're going to hear some music. For those who are seeing this visually or online, you're going to see the first minute of what is essentially a two-minute commercial. Margaret, you want to go ahead and tell us what the narrative is here?
Yeah, the narrative of this is that being a mom is the best and the hardest job in the world. And what we see chronicled here is everything that moms do all around the world to help their child practice, get there early in the morning, pick them up at night, cheer them on. And it's meant to be a tearjerker. And if your tears are jerked easily out of their little ducts, you will, I think, certainly find it that way. It's a fun, inspiring commercial, and I think you will see these kinds of things dominate the ads as well as the storylines and the coverage.
Rod, I said before we went on air that one of the things that struck me about this is, where is poor dad? You know, because dads do all this sort of stuff too. So I really was a little bit concerned about that. But
Dad's busy filming all this. In the
house. That's it, right, and uploading it to YouTube. I should have known. Well, Rod, NBC is not doing this out of the goodness of its heart. It really does want to make some money out of this. And I'm curious what you think, whether or not this is going to be worth the huge financial investment and what the financial stakes really are here.
Well, I guess we'll find out in about 2 weeks and one day, or maybe even sooner than that, as they take their overnight ratings and so forth. I mean, obviously, NBC is putting this thing on, my Lord, how many different channels and online?
Nine is what I'm told.
Some 5,000 and some hours of this coverage, right, much of which is going to be recorded, and well, at least for primetime viewing. Mm-hmm. Other will be live streaming as it happens at 5 and 6 in the morning, our time. So obviously NBC thinks this is going to be a big winner and certainly is investing millions of dollars in it. I forgot now what the point of your question or what the thrust of your question was.
Do you think it's going to be worth the amount of money they're sinking into it?
How can I say? I don't. Obviously they think it is, or they wouldn't be sinking that much money into it. This may be also a way to save NBC and bring us back up into prime time and to number one on the viewing parade. So I wish them luck. I hope that it does succeed.
I didn't mean to interrupt. From an advertiser's standpoint, I think there were 215 million viewers in 2008 in the Beijing Olympics. And these are high-quality viewers.
Is it on television now?
Uh-huh.
Just only?
Mm-hmm. And, of course, this is over the long period of time, mm-hmm. and it's worldwide. But this, like the Super Bowl, is one of the last mass marketing opportunities that you have to get a huge swath of a very desirable audience. And we'll also see that a lot of people are going to be watching with two or three screens. They'll have their computer. They'll have their smartphone. They'll be watching TV. They're going to be having a lot of opportunities to, as we like to say, monetize that content.
Well, in a show like this one, the latest in the Murdoch phone hacking scandal never ceases to amaze. Since last week, Rupert Murdoch himself has stepped down from numerous governing boards, and eight journalists, including Rebecca Brooks, Murdoch's confidant and third in line at the now-defunct News of the World, and Andy Coulson, who left News of the World to become director of communications for current British Prime Minister David Cameron, are now charged in criminal court. Rod, you have spent a career talking to young journalists about doing the right thing, and you've also taught in England. Is that system over there so very different, or is there something else going on here?
Well, first of all, addressing the matter of having taught in England, that was, 14 years ago, and so much has happened since then. I mean, in those days, a hack was a guy driving a cab. We didn't worry about hacking on the Internet. So I would say the technology has brought us, has made a lot of this possible. Second thing is, in terms of what I taught students, I didn't have to worry about something like that. Now, certainly you worried about plagiarizing and just plain copying from another news source without any kind of attribution. You taught over there, Lee. You could probably answer this far better than I can.
I don't think so. I mean, I do think that the journalistic mores are a little bit different. I remember the big scandal that we had when I was there was that my students discovered relatively quickly that in Britain it's okay to lift quotes from a sister publication, across the pond, in this case the Washington Post, and not attribute them. And we had a lot of discussions about that because their sort of sensibilities were very different. Margaret, is Murdoch, at least with the U.S. part of his empire, do you think his newspaper empire is going to hold under this continued assault?
Well, a couple of things related, and I'll get to that. There was a headline in the New York Times this morning that I'd like to ask you about as an ethicist. The headline was, "Phone Hacking Charges Seen as Chill on British Journalism." And the Wall Street Journal actually had a rather more balanced approach to this. I know this was covered in Great Britain, but in the UK. But what do you think of this claim of a chill? And I thought maybe it was just a headline, but they seem to be disturbed that not being able to hack into people's personal information would be a bad thing for journalism.
Well, like I was going to say, it isn't a bad thing for journalism. I can say that the British are much more used to scrutiny in terms of surveillance cameras and all those sorts of things than we Americans are. I also saw that at least one of the journalists who've been charged and billed herself as an investigative reporter said, well, you know, this is just what investigative reporters do. And my response to that was, no, we don't. We do lots of stuff, but this is a thing that we don't do very much, and we probably should do it less. So I guess my response to the New York Times is a chill on what sort of journalism? Are there not other ways to get what are legitimate news stories? Since I personally don't think that Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie's voicemail messages constitute news, although apparently someone did. Well, Ron, in the little bit of time we have left, you brought this one to our attention. People are really exercised about garbage in Colombia.
A few, a vocal minority.
So are there stories here that journalists should be reporting that we're not, that we aren't?
Yeah, I think so. If we can, you know, kind of step back from all this other rich kind of news that's been happening all week. For those of you who are not in the Colombia market or in the immediate area, there is a dispute underway in Colombia, the gem of commotion, where the city is proposing to substitute these roll carts for the garbage bags. And a number of people have been writing the letters to the editor and going to Trib Talk and so forth, complaining, we're elderly or we're physically challenged, we can't handle those things, what's it going to cost, what about our recyclables? So all kinds of questions are being raised, and no one so far as I've been able to figure out has tried to answer them. I think that some reporter needs to go to City Hall, talk to the people pushing this idea, and say, answer these questions in public.
Margaret, in 15 seconds or less, could the city do with a good PR campaign on this one?
No. They could first do with a really good analysis of how people will be injured and go from there to really make good decisions.
Well, whether you like the rolling garbage tubs or not, I'm afraid we're going to have to roll out of here for the evening. I'll be back in the host chair next week, and as usual, always welcome your suggestions for discussion or topics that we should address on this show. I need to acknowledge the efforts of my colleagues, Margaret Duffy and Rod Gillette, and the examples they provide of thoughtful commentary. And we wouldn't be able to do this without able production crew help, technical director Travis McMillan and audio wizard Pat Akers. I'd also like to take this opportunity to thank you for listening and for sharing your opinions about these important stories with us at our blog at kbia.org. Meanwhile, I believe the temperatures are going to descend. For the next few nights, have a wonderful warm evening. This is Lee Wilkins for Views of the News.